Share with them something that opened your heart and fed your mind. 7. Create something together. Start a little business, or work on a story, or paint pictures for fun. Go on a service trip, or build a coffee table, or redecorate your respective kitchens. Do something where you team up for a greater cause. 8. Pay attention to the little things. Notice what they're often most bothered by, what their favorite flavor of ice cream is. Know their Taco Bell order so you can surprise them with it. Not everybody is naturally detail-oriented, so make it an intention to be. People appreciate it more than you realize. 9. Attend your respective religious / spiritual services / practices together. For the sake of understanding, go to their church service one Sunday, or show them how you meditate, or ask them what they believe and why. Let them be your guide through something you otherwise wouldn't know. There's something absolutely extraordinary in learning about someone else's culture, or dogma, or lifestyle, in practicing what it means to lovingly coexist. 10. Plan a short trip. It doesn't have to be elaborate or expensive. Explore a neighboring city for a day or go for a hike. Plan in advance so you have something to look forward to. 11. Integrate them in your other social circles. Merge your friends together for a wine night, no matter how deeply you're convinced they'll have nothing in common. There's something so intimate and special about gathering all the separate parts of your life in one place. 12. Always show up to their baby showers and art exposés and graduations and moving days. Not because that's what good friends / boyfriends / girlfriends do, but because that's what you do when you care about someone else's happiness as much as you do your own. 13. Plan your heart-to-hearts. The older you get, the more inconvenient it becomes to talk until 3 a.m. There's work to do and groceries to buy and parents to call, and you get the picture. So plan ahead if you must. Decide to have a sleepover and keep the next day open so you can stay up and sleep in and relive your middle school glory days. 14. Talk about your families and what it was like growing up. It's one thing to meet your friend / boyfriend / girlfriend's relatives, but it's quite another to hear the whole story, the reality, the not-ready-for-company imperfect picture of what they experienced. This isn't a call to needlessly air the dirty laundry, but rather understand that you won't really know somebody unless you understand the truth of their foundation. 15. Be filterless. Don't mince your words or tailor your opinions or only present the side of you that you feel is acceptable. If they don't want the whole of you, the truth of who you are, they're not right for you anyway. And more importantly, people can sense genuineness and will subconsciously take it as a cue that they're free to be who they really are as well. 83. Let yourself be happier than you think you deserve. If all great things are done by a series of small things put together, then great lives are created by a series of small moments put together, most of which we miss out on because we're writing the synopsis rather than the paragraphs of the chapters. It's as though we live to write our eulogies. We get degrees and spouses and desire storylines and unfolding fates that make sense and flow well, and ultimately write beautiful and admirable stories, but only ones that we will ever tell ourselves. We're never actually remembered for more than who we were and who we loved, and how we lived, in a moment-to-moment sense. The rest, the big, overarching, milestone kind of things, don't matter. And maybe they never did. We miss the moments because we're distracted. Distracted by the one person we search for in a crowd, fearing they're there, even when they're hours and states and other impossibilities away. By the someone who is always on our minds when we're writing or creating or choosing, or riding the train or falling asleep, and we behave as though they are with us, and narrate our lives by what they'd say and feel and think if they were with us, though we know we'd never know that. There's always one daunting task, always one to-do list that fails to include anything surrounding what we actually want to do. Not for work, not for the credit, not out of responsibility, but just because we want to be happy. Always one more promotion, one more move, one more great love to find before we can be happy. But we aren't. We don't choose. We don't think we deserve it. We keep searching, and we keep narrating, and we keep living as though we have a tomorrow to live out all these grand fantasies and promises to ourselves, when the reality is that unless we stop today, we'll live forever on the promise of tomorrow. These are daydreams. They're visions and hopes and issues that don't exist. The minute you start thinking of the past or future, realize that it's only a thought of a thing. A thought that's happening in a now. A now that we're missing. Tomorrow never changes us. Our jobs never change us. Our relationships don't either. Our problems change as the things in our lives do. The issues we take are reflections of what's wrong with us. The people we hate, reflections of our insecurities. No matter how many things come and go, we take the same issues and hate the same people for the same reasons, and never stop to realize that it's not them that we hate. It's the parts of us they force us to recognize. You have to stop living for how other people will remember you. Stop living by telling yourself the story that you think other people will be happy reading, because it's an empty and lifeless one, and it robs you of the thing you're most seeking when you do it. The most important thing is that you do what makes you happy, and that you understand that your happiness is your choice and your responsibility alone. It is not a day or a job or a relationship or a change away. It's right now. The only work to do is to remove the blocks that prevent you from living it out. The only change that has to happen is to you. The untold millions of little moments are what matter. It's not about having a job. It's about having a life that you want to live. It's not about having a degree. It's about the nights you finally felt the opposite of loneliness. It's not about having a relationship. It's about being in one. And it's not about living a life that other people can sum up comfortably. It's about having a life wherein those millions of moments build and corroborate with one another, and you follow them and have more. You won't be there to hear the stories and eulogies they tell of you. You're only here to know them now. 84. How to Think for Yourself, an 8-step guide. Most of the thoughts you experience in a day are not unique or self-generated. Our minds are like computer programs. They seek out, repeat, and believe what they are told to. Few people recognize how deeply their thinking is conditioned, and they assume their thoughts and subsequent feelings are a part of who they are, and so they defend them, passionately. Learning to think for yourself is something you must consciously choose, and very few people do. Here are a few steps to guide you through it, assuming you dissect one idea or opinion at a time. 1. Decipher the origin of the opinion. Recall the first time you experienced it. For example, if you remember being in second grade and hearing a parent say that anybody who isn't pro-life is a murderer, you probably had a very strong reaction to it, being all of 7 years old. Figuring out the origin of your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs shows you how often they are not your own realization or discovery, but someone else's imposition. 2. Determine whether or not your evidence is based in emotion or reason. What are the supporting arguments for your opinion or idea? If they are emotion-based, are the feelings yours or someone else's? If neither, what are the facts that inform your belief? 3. Ask yourself who the opinion benefits. Is it anybody or anything, but either you or the general good of humankind? 4. Consider why opposing ideas could be valid. This is probably the most crucial part, and yet very few people have the wherewithal to consider and discuss opposing ideas without feeling absolutely enraged. It's what happens when we identify with our thoughts too deeply. Regardless, seriously sit down and try to understand the logic, reason, or fear of opposing opinions without passing judgment. 5. Recognize why you feel the way you do about it. Unless you are a trained expert on the topic, any strong emotions that accompany your opinion on it are usually strictly personal and therefore keep you away from being objective and realistic. It would take years and an extraordinary amount of research at the level of PhD candidacy to be in a position to truly understand a nuanced issue enough to have an extremely strong feeling about it. 6. Research. If you are as passionate as you claim to be about a particular idea, research it and make sure your ideas aren't unfounded. Then follow a few reputable newspapers, unbiased news sources, and research centers to keep yourself up to date with what's being discovered and discussed in the world. 7. Ask yourself what the outcome would be if everybody in the world thought the way you do. It's the best way to determine whether or not an idea only benefits your ego. 8. Envision your most actualized self. What would they think if not this? Imagining what your best self would say about an issue is a pretty good way to determine what you should shift your mindset toward. 85. The very important reason why we choose to love people who cannot love us back. The purpose of a relationship is not to be loved perfectly or forever. It is not to have our every whim and wish met and fulfilled. It is not to be completed, or to have our minds and hearts fueled by the hormonal stimulation we think is the feeling of love. The purpose of a relationship is not the universe's way of saying, "You're worthy, and here's someone to prove it." The purpose of a relationship is to see ourselves completely. It is to see the parts of ourselves that we are otherwise unconscious of. The purpose of a relationship is to infuriate and overjoy and destroy us so we can see what angers us, what thrills us, and where we need to give ourselves love. The purpose of a relationship is not to fix us or heal us or to make us whole and happy. It is to show us where we need fixing and what parts of us are still broken, and perhaps the most brutal of all, that nobody can do this work or make us happy but ourselves. We choose to love people who cannot love us back to teach ourselves that we are, in fact, worthy of being loved back. We choose these people because they represent the parts of us that we don't love. Why else would we waste our time on people who don't return our affection? We choose to love these people because they are the only ones with whom we share an intimate connection deep enough that it can awaken and illuminate the darkest corners of ourselves. And they are the only ones who can leave and let us do what we are here to do, resolve and actualize and heal them on our own. It is not the nature of love that people struggle with, but what it is designed to do. Most of our turmoil simply comes from never having been told that love will keep breaking our hearts until they open, and that we will be the ones throwing ourselves in again and again. Our life partners are the people who come after the love that opens us. Our big loves are the loves that emerge after we think we've lost them already. They come after we're ready, after we've cleared out the damage and debris. Only after we've learned what it means to love ourselves. It is in this we realize that love is sharing what we already have, not relying on someone else to give us something to supplement. It is in this we realize how crucial it was to love the people who could not love us back. They were never meant to, and the rest only depends on how long it takes us to realize this. 86. Not everybody will love you in a way you understand. So much of the tension that turns to friction, and so much of the friction that creates the fault lines that erupt in our relationships, has to do with the ways we perceive love, the ways we expect it, and how the love we think we deserve does or doesn't match up to what we get and, oftentimes, give. For a lot of people, it's not about whether or not they're in love with someone. It's the nuances that come along with being in love. It's how they're in love with them. It's the ounce of uncertainty we're told we shouldn't have. The notion that they're so young, that someone without such and such an issue could come along and be better than what they have now, that there's better out there. The ex who's more convenient, the distance, the fear of commitment, the timing, the distractions, the impulse to try something else. And every last one of us can admit to knowing what it's like to be circling through these notions, trapped between loving someone and wanting to choose otherwise. The problem is that we seldom realize that the heart is not a one-time expended thing. You can't put someone in it and expect that to heal the scarred contours. You have to realize that often the struggle is that we leave, even though we love them, and we fight, even though we love them, and we do wrong by them, even though we love them, and it's not because we don't love them enough, but that all of these things can coexist within us, and the presence of one love doesn't make another go away, but it doesn't heal the hurt at its root either. It can just mask it for a little bit. We can expect that our hearts are able to hold more than one thing, more than one person, more than one feeling, but we cannot expect that they'll all coexist perfectly. Love grows, and it grows you from the inside out. It expands you, but the expansion doesn't eliminate whatever else was there beforehand. So it doesn't always look the way we think it should. There are hidden spaces and depths within us, and love sometimes comes out differently when it creates the echo of going through those parts of us as well. Some people love silently. Some love without ever realizing they're in love. Love doesn't look loving at all. It's masked by fear, forced into remission and acted on in bouts of anger and disappointment. Sometimes it's not being able to look at someone after they're gone. Sometimes it's not being able to stop, and most times it's not being able to tell them either way. It sometimes comes out punishing like the parents who try to force us into compliance, not realizing that you cannot shame people into changing, that their expression of anger is a mechanism of their ego, not of their love. We are not inherently whole once we've found another person to fit into us. Nobody can do that for us. We have to fill those spaces ourselves. So sometimes it goes misunderstood. But the comfort is in knowing that it's not what we misunderstand about love, as much as it is about how we let the misunderstanding open and expand us. You let the love and all the twisted ways it's morphed and sullied push you into transforming yourself and your life out of necessity. You eventually realize it was love that created you, not the pain that is the byproduct of lost love. And it wasn't the love someone didn't give. It was the love you had to find in yourself. The only matter is that we let love do what it's supposed to. Give us more of it, even, and probably especially, when it means we have to take it for ourselves. Sometimes we choose people to show us the hidden parts of ourselves. Sometimes we choose people who we know will hurt us. Sometimes it's the only way we can be acquainted with our inner beings. And even though we don't understand it, it's often the most honest, beautiful way we love ourselves too. 87. How to tame your inner demons. I used to think that taming your inner demons was a matter of transcending them. I used to believe that the gnawing notion of not good enough would be silenced when I was able to move past my mind's eye, because of course, our inner demons do not base their case in reality. Our inner demons strike us at our sore spots. They recite to us all the things that we fear people will interpret us to be. They keep us stuck in the place where what other people perceive is reality, though of course, those perceptions are extensions of those people, and these ones are ours. I thought they would dissolve as soon as I stopped looking at my life analytically and started going through the motions as a person experiencing my thoughts and feelings, not the person who is my thoughts and feelings. But what I came to realize is that every part of you must work in tandem, and as soon as I needed to do something requiring thought and process, I was back to square one. It's nothing to get over, and it's nothing to disregard. It's only something to acknowledge and understand, and then cultivate differently. Because mindset is a cultivation, and to that end, it is ultimately a choice. We can change it. If we don't, we will remain at the whim of other people's actions and our own irrational gremlins that do nothing but prevent us from living out what we know to be true. And when these two forces collide and disrupt one another, we'll find ourselves in the pits of anxiety and depression because something is trying to make its way out of us and something else is preventing it from doing so. The antidote here is awareness. As soon as you realize your thought is coming from a place of irrationality and fear, you've taken a step towards silencing it. As soon as you discover that you don't have to listen to that voice, and that you are not that voice, you no longer have to be controlled by it. You'll start to understand that having self-doubt is human. Irrational fears are too. There's no part of this that's weird or strange or wrong. It's simply nature. But if we want to step beyond it, we have to reach beyond it and start choosing. Choosing what we consume. How we structure our days and what we give our time to. What we assign value and meaning to and how much. Our natural default setting isn't the one we have to operate on for the rest of our lives. The longer we stay in allowing ourselves to be completely overtaken by every deprecating thought that runs through our minds, we'll continue to cement ourselves beneath those beliefs, and they'll become real. Because this isn't about believing that one day we'll never have passing thoughts of judgment toward ourselves. This isn't about thinking we'll ever not care what other people think, even just a little. These aspects of humanness are universal and unchanging and programmed for a reason. But those reasons have little to do with us finding happiness. And we have to make the choice for ourselves. We'll never not care, and we'll never not hear them. It's only a matter of whether or not we'll act based on them. 88. Why we reject positive thinking. A large reason why people write off self-help or positive psychology as fluff is because of how impossible it seems to accomplish. Positive thinking seems simple enough, so why is it that we have such a difficult time with it? Well, the answer is simple, and it's not. There's a lot of subconscious bias against positive thinking, and that accumulates after long periods of time reinforcing your negative beliefs. To shift to a more positive mindset requires getting past that first period of angry disbelief. Here, a few other reasons why we reject positivity. 1. we see it as naive. We falsely associate negativity with depth, and so to be aware of the negative, or to be unenthused, under-emotional or passive, is to also be cool. This is why we think of the cool kids in school as not caring much. 2. We're constantly reinforcing our subconscious belief in the negative. The very nature of personal belief is that which experience has proven true to us. This is impossible, however, when we are subconsciously seeking out evidence to support the negative ideas we are constantly entertaining. 3. We are more inherently fascinated by the negative in the world because we do not understand it. Because we do not understand the purpose or reason for pain and negativity, we find it unknown and mysterious, therefore, more crucial to attend to. We're fascinated by the intensity of something we don't understand, so we end up fueling it more, and more simply, by paying attention to it. 89. The philosophy of non-resistance. The difference between going with the flow and becoming a doormat. When the Western Zen Renaissance began in the 50s, a movement to which many have credited Alan Watts's work for inspiring, it was a manifestation aligned precisely what ancient teachings hoped and intended for humanity, to adopt it into our lifestyle. Yet in essence got lost in translation. We began to interpret spirituality from the perspective of the ego, when it was not designed for that, and we do not realize we are doing it because it is the only thing we know. Take, for example, the concept of non-resistance. From our understanding, it is the process of consciously releasing expectations and attachments to outcomes, which the Taoists argue is the root of all suffering. Yet we don't really know what it means to be non-resistant, so we regard it as a sort of ego surrender, where our idea of letting go spirals into surrounding control of life and simply allowing whatever, no matter how terrible. This is how the misperception that spirituality is passive and lazy is born. The way that non-resistance was intended to be practiced was by striking a fine balance between what you can and cannot control in your life. To put it metaphorically, it is to steer the ship along with the current, not against it. It does not mean to surrender all control or effort. It simply means to wield it more wisely. This is such an exemplary way to characterize the nature of the ego, but as tradition would teach, the ego is not bad. That is another Western stereotype. The ego serves an absolutely crucial purpose. It is simply a matter of recognizing that and surrendering to it, rather than our fear and lack of awareness. In this case, it is realizing that the path of non-resistance does not call for us to completely surrender to whatever happens in life. Rather, it is to be discerning about how we exert control and realize the fact that the current is more powerful than we are. We can either stage a fight we'll always lose, or let ourselves be carried. 90. You have to be kindest to yourself when it seems least deserved. We believe that being cruel to ourselves is a self-preservation tactic. We pick out our flaws because we are survivalists by nature. We have an itch to be aware of what other people could deem unworthy and insufficient, so we dwell on every possible flaw someone could rip apart and use against us. But it never makes us stronger. It doesn't make us immune to someone doing so simply because we got there first. Believing what other people could say before they say it doesn't give us a defense against it. You have to stop believing that you need other people's permission to be okay with yourself. That however you do or don't align with what other people value determines your worth. That however the world does or doesn't show you kindness is a direct reflection of how much you deserve it. You have to be kind to yourself. Even, and probably most especially, when it seems least deserved. Telling ourselves everything other people could possibly use against us doesn't numb us to it. It only makes us believe we are worth those words and that those accusations would be valid. Besides, there are so many variables to whether or not someone will grace you with their approval and praise that it's nearly impossible to blanket over everyone and everything completely and universally. And that's what's required if validation is to be sought. Certainty. The exact kind we can't find in ourselves. But people's opinions, especially negative ones, largely stem from what they know they don't have and can't do. You eventually have to stop basing your self-worth on the insecurities of others and start basing it on your own genuine convictions, no matter how long it takes for you to find them. I always knew that my belief that I wasn't worth it wasn't the reason I played my own antagonist. My fear of being hurt by other people was. The only way you can ever really heal or find some sense of genuine contentment is in narrating your life as someone who loves you would. Because you should love you. So today, while I was getting down on myself for something writing-related, because that's how life works sometimes, I was about to text my one friend who always encourages me and tells me to keep going, but I realized, why can't I tell myself what she's going to say? Why do I have to wait for someone else to give me those words? It's not that I shouldn't appreciate her encouragement, but why do I value the thoughts and opinions of other people more than I do my own? It's a shift of mindset. In that respect, it's a choice. It's choosing to get help, to move away, to end a relationship, to rekindle one again. It's feeding yourself and making sure you get enough sleep. It's tenderly, constantly reminding yourself that you are going to be okay. Not because you're delusional, not because that's what everyone says, but because okay is where we all end up. Not because anybody else tells us that we will, but because we find it on our own and learn to believe it for ourselves. 91. The 15 most common types of distorted thinking. To think well is to think objectively and factually. The human brain is wired to affirm itself. We are programmed to find evidence that supports what we most want to believe. Unless our subconscious is clear, it's how we create our most compelling convictions. If we were raised believing we are social outcasts, we're always seeking out evidence that we are, in fact, disliked by peers. Like most things, distorted thinking tends to happen in patterns. We aren't alone in the things that most deeply plague or fascinate or panic us, and in fact, you'll probably find comfort in the fact that there are terms for them. In 1981, Dr. Matthew McKay, Dr. Martha Davis, and Patrick Fanning outlined exactly what these are and how they tend to manifest. Here, 17 of the most prominent types of distorted thinking. 1. Filtering. Filtering is choosing to have a selectively informed perspective. It is to take the negative details of a situation and magnify them while filtering the positive aspects out. Picking out a single detail and coloring entire events by it isolates good and bad experiences from one another, and therefore, they become larger and more awful, or better, than they are in reality. 2. Polarization. The hallmark of distortion is a hyper-reliance on dichotomies. Things are either good or bad, right or wrong, and no in-between. It is to perceive everything within extremes and be closed to a middle ground. This tends to manifest most strongly in self-perceptions. You're either perfect or you're a failure. 3. Overgeneralization. You come to conclusions based on a single piece of evidence or a single experience. If something bad happens once, out of fear that it will happen again, you expect it so you can prepare for it. The language this kind of thinking usually entails is the use of always or never to illustrate a problem. This kind of distortion can lead to a restricted life, as you avoid experiences because you gauge failure on a single event or instance. 4. Mind reading. You assume to know what people are feeling and why they act the way they do, especially when it comes to how they feel about you. This is usually due to your own projections and biases. You can only comprehend that people feel the way you would and respond the way you do to certain situations, simply because you aren't familiar with anything else. 5. Catastrophizing. You always assume that the absolute worst will happen. It is to take random circumstances and to imagine they are indicative of the most disastrous outcome. It is a symptom of not trusting oneself and not believing you have the capacity to adapt to change. If you imagine the worst is always happening, nothing can shock or surprise you. 6. Personalization. You interpret everything that happens within the context of how it affects and applies to you. You think that everything people say or do or infer is for or against you. It is the inability to realize that a world exists outside of how you engage with it. Other symptoms are trying to compare yourself to others, as though someone else's intelligence or attractiveness means something about your own. The basic thinking error is that you interpret each experience, each conversation, each look as a clue to your worth and value. 7. Control fallacies. There are two-way control fallacies work. Either you feel externally controlled, you see yourself as helpless or a victim of fate, or you feel internally controlled, which means you think of yourself as responsible for the pain and happiness of everyone around you. Both are usually symptomatic of not taking control of your life in a healthy, productive way. 8. Fallacy of fairness. You believe that you know what's fair, right, and just, and that the only problem is other people don't agree with you. You do not understand that truths can coexist, and by virtue of seeing your own opinions as valid, experience has proved them to be, you assume they are valid for everyone else as well, and if they would only adopt them, their problems would be solved. 9. Blaming. The sister issue of projection. When you blame, you hold everyone and everything responsible for your pain. On the flip side, you blame yourself for every problem that comes up. Regardless, it's a distorted way of holding someone or something accountable for an issue. 10. Shoulds. You have a list of rules about what people should and shouldn't do that you grew up believing were unquestionably true. These were imposed on you through culture, family, religion, schooling, etc. People who break these rules anger you, and you do everything to avoid doing so yourself. Because you believe the rules are indisputable, you put yourself in the position of being able to judge and find fault in everyone else around you. 11. Emotional reasoning. You believe that what you feel must be true, without evaluating it at all. If you feel bored, unloved, unintelligent, unsuccessful, even momentarily, you assume it's true just because you have felt it. A lot of internal conflict arises out of the inability to reconcile our emotions with our thinking processes. 12. Fallacy of change. You expect that other people can change, and that they must, because your hopes for happiness depend on it. This leads to you putting a lot of pressure on people when in reality, you are simply corroding your relationship with them. The underlying assumption of this thinking style is that your happiness depends on the actions of others. Your happiness actually depends on the thousands of large and small choices you make in your life. 13. Global labeling. You generalize one or two qualities that you see in your immediate social circle as being a judgment about all of humanity. Global labeling creates a world that's stereotypical and one-dimensional. Labeling yourself in such a way is an impediment to self-esteem. Labeling others in such a way results in relationship problems and prejudice. 14. Being right. You feel as though you are always on trial to prove that your opinions, actions, and choices are correct, or at least more correct than an alternative. Being wrong is associated with being bad or unworthy. Your need to be right often results in closed-mindedness, as defensiveness does not leave room to consider another idea, perhaps one that is more informed than your own. 15. Heaven's reward fallacy. You imagine that someone is keeping score of all the wrong and right doings in your life. You expect that your sacrifice, good doing, or self-denial will pay off, even if there is no clear logical way that it will. You are constantly doing the right thing, even if you don't feel like it. This leads to feeling physically and emotionally depleted, because there is no actual reward in the sacrifice and denial. 92. 101 things that are more important than what your body looks like. 1. How kind you are to the people who can't do anything for you. 2. That you are aware of the fact that the last thing someone will remember after you are dead is what pant size you wore. 3. The understanding that what we are beneath our skin is more real than what's on it, or how many layers of cells lie between. 4. The knowing that someone else's judgment of what your body is or isn't does not make it any more or less of that thing. 5. How gracefully you can accept the things that aren't meant for you. 6. How hard you are willing to fight for the things that are. 7. That you accept other people's bodies for what they are. 8. That you accept other people for who they are. 9. That the greatest thing we can do with our bodies is let them facilitate us lending ourselves to the people who need what we can give. 10. That you can taste your favorite food and treat yourself to it as often as you want to. 11. The knowing that nothing is permanent here, especially our physicality. This is a ride. The car needs to work to get you through it. People will judge you as much as they want, but their judgment will be theirs to reconcile, not yours. 12. The knowing that what we really need, on a core level, is the love and acceptance of other people, unconditionally. Maybe not everybody, maybe not many people, but in principle, by someone. Our ability to give that far outweighs how we look while giving it. 13. That you can taste pizza. 14. That you cannot only be okay with your body when it looks and feels the way you want it to. That you find comfort in sometimes being very uncomfortable, and that you know it is not your responsibility to defer to anyone else's level of comfort, or lack thereof. 15. That you have a mind to comprehend whom a person is, and a body to show them that you understand them. 16. That you can cuddle with your pets. 17. That you pay your own bills. 18. The fact that we do indeed have these internal atlases, and that when we feel an unexplainable pull, we follow them, for they know much more than our minds can conceive. 19. That some people can create another human life if so they choose. That in itself is a freaking miracle. 20. That you can swim and run and cry and scream and dance and float on water and feel weightless and free. 21. That your mouth can tell the people you love that you love them. 22. And kiss some of them, too. 23. That you are able to evolve and change. 24. That you can make conscious decisions for yourself. 25. That you are conscious as a principle. 26. That you know how to let go and have a goddamn great time. 27. that you have the ability to let go of your attachment to how you believe things should look and embrace them as they are. 28. That beauty is not quantifiable. 29. That you realize food is not the enemy. 30. That you understand how contrived our idea of beauty is, how it has been engraved in our minds silently, in photos and side comments and expectations we learn from peers and mentors, unintentionally or not. 31. That you never have to accept a narrow definition of what's beautiful. 32. That you understand that people will love you more for loving yourself. 33. That you know to love yourself means to be okay with not being totally okay with some parts of you all the time. 34. That you can cultivate your beliefs through your own experiences, learnings, and to whatever rings true. 35. That you can and do make decisions for yourself. 36. That you can stand up for yourself when passivity is no longer a choice. 37. That you can stand up for others when passivity is no longer a choice. 38. That it is only very small people who feel the need to make comments about other people's appearance. That such an act comes from a very deep, very insecure place, and is not someone you should get angry at, but show love to, because they need it. 39. The fact that you can use your body to read your favorite books and hear this right now. 40. That your body facilitates the things you love most in your life. Your legs let you travel, and your arms hug the people you love. 41. That you will never really know what great things lie ahead, and though the unknown may seem scary, that you aren't supposed to, it's elusiveness that makes things feel incredible when they arrive. 42. How honest you can be with yourself about yourself. 43. How honest you can be about yourself to other people. 44. That you can use your body to play with the little kids in your life and to tell them and show them that you love them. 45. That through your body, you can feel happiness and joy. 46. That through your body, you can feel sadness and pain and can grow and learn from that. 47. Being able to experience the unprecedented high that comes from realizing the million things that seemingly didn't work out in the past was some universal conspiracy to bring you to exactly the right place, somewhere far beyond where you could have imagined for yourself. It will happen if it hasn't yet. Just wait. 48. The ability to process the kind of unprecedented compassion that is displayed in the world daily, but is sometimes overshadowed by the alternative. 49. Having eyes to see the love of your life, hands to hold them, and a mouth to speak to them, a gut instinct to know they are your soulmate, and a mind to understand that they agree. 50. How well you perform at your job. 51. How adamantly you stick to what you believe. 52. How fiercely you pursue that which you feel most called to. 53. How earnestly you can laugh at yourself. 54. How honest you are willing to be in regards to your shortcomings and what you do in light of them, not in spite of them. 55. The tiny acts of kindness and courage that we perform daily, because at the end, that may be our only purpose here. 56. How often you make time to do the things you want, not the things that are expected of you. 57. That you stop judging and berating people for their own imperfections. 58. That you have the ability to hear the music you love. 59. That alternatively, You have the ability to feel the vibrations of music if you can't hear it. 60. The knowing that the lack of one sense, one talent, one ability does not lessen you. It defines you as someone cut out for a challenge above others. 61. The understanding that the pursuit of physical beauty will eventually be futile. We all sag, wrinkle, and age the same in the end. 62. The genuine understanding that most of the time you cannot equate your health to your appearance. 63. The genuine understanding that you have no right to judge someone else's health by their appearance. 64. That you can use your body to perform the things you most truly love to do, write, dance, sing, what the hell ever. 65. That you use your body for sex, for good, consensual, wild sex when you want, where you want, and never for any other reason but that. 66. That your body is not for the consumption of others, and that there is never a reason to do something to it that doesn't make you happy but will appease others. 67. That you are not at fault for how society views physical appearances, but you do have a responsibility to yourself to defy it consciously. 68. That you know what to say when the people you love are most hurting and need those words of comfort. 69. That you know when to shut the hell up and just be present for them. 70. That you know how to grieve and mourn the things that will inevitably pass. 71. That you know how to embrace and enjoy the things that will invariably pass. 72. That you donate the things you don't need to the people who do need them. 73. That you don't adopt other people's confining, cruel words as your own. 74. That you make your own money to spend as you see fit. 75. How often you tell the people who you love that you love them while you have them every day, in every way you can, because you never know. 76. That you sacrifice when a sacrifice needs to be given. 77. That you have the ability to feel warmth and smell your childhood home and have your senses act as transmitters back to the things and people you would have otherwise forgotten about. 78. That you embrace love, no matter how scary it is. 79. That you are an honest person, in word, promise, work, and heart. 80. How able you are to put your ego aside and apologize when an apology is due. 81. How genuinely you apologize. It says a lot about a person. 82. How well you take care of yourself when you most need to be taken care of. 83. That you make gifts and mix CDs and write notes and send letters to people just for the sake of making them smile. 84. How genuinely you see all people as equals. 85. That you stop apologizing for doing what you want with your body. 86. That you realize your mind's capacity is limitless if you so choose to pursue it. 87. That you embrace releasing your mind from having an input on the things that inherently require your instinctual feelings. 88. That you have little things in your life that genuinely make you happy. 89. That you have the courage to go back and reconcile when you're at a standstill and someone needs to cave. 90. That you can rejoice in other people's successes. 91. And not rejoice in other people's failures. 92. That your body is capable of understanding when someone is giving you that very specific, I love you look, and that you are so lucky to ever have had it in the first place. 93. That you spend your life doing something greater than just making yourself happy in the moment. 94. That you realize that to help others, you must first help yourself. 95. That you understand how the last two points both contradict and necessitate one another. 96. That you give yourself enough sleep. 97. And enough vegetables. Sorry to nag you, but that shit is important. 98. How you feel about your body. 99. That you forgive the people who are cruel to you over your body, and realize that they are hurting somewhere too, and that people only ever lash out at what strikes a chord within them. 100. That you forgive yourself for being cruel to yourself over your body. 101. That you use it to write things like this and send the message on. 93. Seven Zen Principles and How to Apply Them to Modern Life. Our biggest aversion to psychological guidance systems, religious or not, tends to be skepticism bred out of assumed inapplicability. We'll trust lifestyle magazines and blog posts and cultural norms. This is simply because they make sense to us. They become self-evident truth when we can easily apply them to our issues. But we don't often consider the source or the intention or the long-term significance of what it is we begin to believe in. When the extent of our personal philosophy is essentially to just do what we're told without questioning, we end up serving consumerism, or ego, or misguided religious figures, or someone else's desire for control. Despite being a derivative of Buddhist teaching, Zen is simply the art of self-awareness. It does not dictate what you should feel or believe in, how you should be, or what you should do, only that you should be conscious of your experience, fully immersed in it. It's for this reason that Zen principles are universal. They can apply to any dogma or lifestyle, essentially. So here are 8 ancient teachings of Zen and how to navigate them in the modern world. 1. Your experience is constructed by your mind. The Yogacara discourse essentially explains how our mind's perceptions create our experiences. Therefore, we must realize that even despite our disposition, we can create a different experience simply by shifting and choosing what to focus on. We are raised to believe that we cannot choose what we think about, when, in fact, we can. Not every fear feeling or negative thought is an invitation to explore it to a resolutive end. 2. Your concept of self is an illusion and construct as well. Who you are is an essence, an energy. That's it. That's why it's never one thing for too long, or in any given context. That's why it's so difficult to understand yourself. You're more than the limiting definitions and titles repetitive habits and jobs and roles provide. However, most of us only understand ourselves as we imagine other people see us. Writer, teacher, mom, student, basketball player, good person, etc. Most of our issues surround trying to manipulate the ego, trying to inflate or immortalize the self, trying to shift and change how we think other people see us, therefore how we believe we exist in reality, and so how we should see ourselves. Mastering the idea of self is knowing that you can play out the illusion of who you are and what you do, while not being so lost in it that it controls you. 3. You need not believe in anything. You only need to follow what feels true in the moment. The trouble with adhering to a certain set belief system without question is that when you value or consider the voices that were implanted into you by someone else's dogma or teaching, you start trusting that more than you trust yourself. and you'll end up either very lost or very confused, battling between what you think is right and what you feel is true. If you aren't living your life by what you know to be true,